I picked up a little soundbite from a film, True Detective. You might have seen it, Matthew McConaughey. And the other one, I forgot his name. But anyhow, I thought this was pretty amusing, so I cut the clip out of the film to run it for you.
He's a failure.
And I forgot to tell you, this was these two detectives had gone to this tent revival meeting. They're looking for a guy. But the conversation between the two detectives is very interesting. One is agnostic, maybe atheist, but pretty logically speaking. The other one's sort of nominal Christian, but he's a rounder, he's a whoremonger, he's a drunk. So let's listen to this interplay between these two detectives as they're standing at the back of this crowd out in nowhere's land in a revival tent.
Where is natural?
Parish FD said the church burned down 4 months earlier. No prince put out an APB on Friends of Christ. A week later, they were in Franklin. Revival ministry, old time religion. You can imagine what Mr. Charisma thought of that.
Who do you think the average IQ that this group is, huh?
Can you see Texas up there on your high horse? What do you know about these people?
Just observation and deduction. See a propensity for obesity, poverty, the yen for fairy tales. Folks putting what few bucks they do have in the little wicker baskets being passed around. I think it's safe to say that nobody here is going to be splitting the atom, Marty.
You see that? Your fucking attitude. Not everybody wants to sit alone in an empty room beating off the murder manuals. Some folks enjoy community, the common good.
Yeah, but the common good's got to make up fairy tales, and it's not good for anybody.
Your sorrows pin you to this place. They divide you from what your heart knows. And there are a lot of good hearts out there. I'm looking out there. I'm seeing a lot of good hearts out there. I see a lot of good out there.
I mean, can you imagine if people didn't believe or the things they'd get up to?
Exact same thing they do now. Just out in the open.
Bullshit. There'd be a fucking freak show of murder and debauchery, and you know it.
If the only thing keeping a person decent is the expectation of divine reward, then, brother, that person is a piece of shit. And I'd like to get as many of them out in the open as possible.
Well, I guess your judgment is infallible, piece of shit-wise. You think that notebook is a stone tablet?
What's it say about life? You gotta get together. Tell yourself stories that violate every law of the universe. Just to get through the goddamn day.
What's that say about your reality, Marty? When you get to talking like this, you sound panicked.
You figure it's all a scam, huh?
Mm.
All them folks?
Mm-hmm.
They just wrong?
Oh, yeah. Been that way since one monkey looked at the sun and told the other monkey, he said, for you to give me your fucking share. People. So goddamn frail, they'd rather put a coin in a wishing well than buy dinner.
Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ, your arms open and closed. The echoes of my life can never contain to see the truth about you. You move the feather in the ash, you touch the leaf with its flame.
Transference of fear and self-loathing to an authoritarian vessel. It's catharsis. He absorbs their dread with his narrative. Because of this, he's effective in proportion to the amount of certainty he can project. Certain linguistic anthropologists think that religion is a language virus that rewrites pathways in the brain, dulls critical thinking.
Well, I don't use $10 words as much as you, but
For a guy who sees no point in existence, you sure fret about it an awful lot. And you still sound panicked.
At least I'm not racing to a red light.
Yeah, man, at least I'm not racing to the red light. That was a, to me, that was a great intercourse between those two guys. That's funny, but it's sad too, because it's so true, so true. And every day I live, the more it makes sense. Yeah, baby. Anyhow, there you go. True Detective, one of the best films I've seen in the last two or three years. I watch a lot of films, but that True Detective, that was a hell of a movie. White Area and Resistance Radio calling. White Area and Resistance Radio calling. This is White Area and Resistance Radio calling, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, deep in the bunker here beneath the rich soil of North Central Indiana in Indiana, yeah. And the sun is out. We had a lot of rain yesterday, but beautiful today, boys. Absolutely beautiful. Well, I started doing what I said I was going to do this morning by putting up on our two Aryan Announce phone lines about 15 minutes of a show. I think that's the best for everybody, because that way I don't have to do it. Number one, I don't have to do it twice. And number two, you get an idea. The people out there who don't have a computer, or they don't have the money, they don't think to subscribe to the show, are able to hear what the show is all about, and whether they like it or not. And also, they should send in a few bucks to support the show and support resist.com. Meanwhile, you subscribers, you get the whole nine yards, baby. Yeah, right. Right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station here. And we've been pumping a lot of gas lately. I guess it's summertime. Everybody's running around to see their in-laws, baby. Yeah. Also, they're spending a lot of money on gas to fill up these damn weapons of mass destruction, these motorized ones, and the ones they're buying here and taking home. Yeah, so we've been doing the bang-up business in the gasoline business. Yeah, that's right. We've been selling a lot of beer, too, over at the tavern. Wow, a lot of beer. Had a lot of karaoke singers coming in here from all over the place. Well, let's get to the news here. I think I'm going to finish up A Man Called Lucy here, and we've got just a few pages left, and I want to get that out of the road, and I surely hope that you've listened closely to the reading and begin to get an understanding of World War II and what the hell was going on and how screwed up it was and how totally insane it was to even happen, and how many ways there was of avoiding it instead of being right or left wing and going way out on a limb both ways. You know, war is hell. Even that asshole Harry Truman... No, was it Harry Truman? I don't know. One of them said that. War is hell. Yeah, it's worse than hell, because hell doesn't exist. But being torn apart on the battlefield, fighting for some bullshit, you think you're fighting for your country, and you're just fighting for the corporations and whoever else is in the saddle, is what a waste. What a waste. I just heard this sniper guy's wife, they made the movie about, she was on radio today, and boy, is she just as screwed up as he was. But I would say she's more of a victim than he was. And I think it's sort of karma that he was shot by another veteran on the firing range, who this guy that shot him was just as screwed up and had his brain muddled by the system as the shooter. I don't. When they start talking about all our war heroes, I don't get into that shit. I think that most people, if they had any brains, would stay away from war altogether. Personal warfare? Yeah, hell yes. Guy kind of tries to kill you, rob you with a gun or a knife, whether you got a pitchfork or a sword or whatever, you fight to the death. I have no qualms about using violence properly and for the right reasons. And it's usually something that's happened close to home. Using violence on people thousands of miles away that have not tried to kill you is criminal, pure and simple. So when these guys down at the American Legion and places like that yap about the great battles where we firebombed Tokyo and dropped an atomic bomb on Japan, and fortunately they didn't have the atomic bomb ready in time because their first choice was to drop it on Germany. How would you have liked that? So all the excuses that both sides make for the war, the pro-Hitler ones always say, oh, well, the Russians were going to attack and all that. And then the other side, they got their side too, you know. So anyhow, it's all bullshit, boys and girls, and don't follow behind people that are preaching what a magnificent thing was going to war. We've lost, 6,000-7,000 over there in the Iraq area and over there. And it's all about money, all about narcotics and money and everything else. So don't get into that bag. And if you do, don't complain to me. Don't expect me to come around to the Veterans Hospital and cry over your missing legs and arms, because you've been forewarned by not only myself, but many, many other people to don't do it. Don't go. All my greatest enemies are right here in the United States, and most and a hell of a lot of them are within 100 miles. I could find more enemies in Chicago than I could in all the other countries in the world, probably. Yeah. And as far as starting some serial killer operation going after all those enemies, there's too goddamn many of them, man. You couldn't even scratch the surface of the people who need killing in this country. I sure am not going to do it. I think that the time is going to come when this whole thing blows sky high and is killing from one area of the country to the other. And when that time comes, I would expect everybody that's got any balls to be ruthless white warriors. But right now, hell, this is nothing but a zoo. And to go out on a limb thinking you're going to stop it by knocking off some people on the street like that crazy-ass Glenn Miller and people like that, forget it. Forget it. It just shows you how stupid you are if you think you can. So anyhow, but people are going to do it, you know, on both sides, or all three sides, or all four sides. They're still going to do it. They're going to go out there and say, well, I'm going to win the war for the white race, and I'm going to blow Rastus to pieces here and hang him from a tree. Yeah, right. So you'll spend the rest of your life in the prison. You haven't accomplished a goddamn thing. If you could wave a magic wand and get all these niggers in the whole country over to Africa magically, that would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. Or if you could wave a taco around in the air and all these 25 million mestizos would magically be transported back to Mexico and Central America and wherever the hell they came from, now that would be wonderful. But it's not going to be done like that. And until there's a major, major upheaval in this country, there's not many possibilities. That's true. So anyhow, that's for all you FBI guys and CIA guys, and I'm thinking I'm going to be part of some stupid deal, or my friends are going to be part of some stupid deal to run out here and go crazy, you're going to be waiting a hell of a long time, because you people are crazier than we are. For those of you who think that gassing all the Jews is going to change anything, that's ridiculous too, because the whole Christian religion came right out of Judaism, and all of Islam came out of Judaism. And there's so many Judaized Christians. In fact, they're more Judaized than most Jews that I know, that I've met. And the Islamics, they're really crazy like the Christians used to be. But these Christians nowadays, if shit goes wrong for them, these fundamentalists, they're going to go crazy. They're going to go crazy, man. You got to stay out of their way. Like a friend of mine, when I was 16 years old, working in the back of a TV shop as an apprentice while I was going to high school, told me, "Tommy," I said, "What, Bert?" "I want to tell you one thing. I'm going to give you one piece of advice. You better listen." I said, "Okay." He said, "If the shit hits the fan, get away from everybody. Get as far away from the crowd as you can get. And that's going to be the main way you're going to survive." And that was in 1954 or 55 he told me that. And I've never forgotten it. I want to see how it works. You watch the news clips of these earthquakes and typhoons and all that crap that are happening around the world, and watch how the public acts. Watch how the masses act. They go crazy, man. They stampede down the street, stomping on men, women, and children, and killing anybody gets in their way. They go crazy. Just stay away from the crowd, baby. If you happen to live in a city, you better be armed to the goddamn teeth, I'm telling you, with anything you can get. Well, let's finish this up on a man called Lucy. His agents had located Christian Schneider and Rachel Dubendorfer when they appeared at Foote's flat with Lucy's messages. They continued to watch the couple closely and noticed that they sometimes met at Lucerne Bookstore. A quick check revealed that the bookseller was a German emigre. Where did he come from? Why hadn't he presented himself to the National Socialist Organization set up by the party in Switzerland? Only one answer was possible. He was an enemy of the Reich. Perhaps he, too, was one of the gang passing intelligence to the Russians. The search began again. This time, Roger Masson decided to end it once and for all. On May 9, 1944, Rudolf Rösler, Lucy, was escorted under heavy guard to the Bois Mermet, the prison of Lausanne. Christian Schneider, Rachel Dubendorfer, her daughter Tamara, and Paul Bocher were taken to Saint-Antoine, the Geneva prison. The prison was just about the only place in Switzerland that was inaccessible to the SD. Schellenberg knew this, as he also knew that he had no other means left of fulfilling his mission of tracking down these high-ranking people in the spy network. He had underestimated the Swiss brigadier. Masson had beaten him hands down. He tried to stifle his intense bitterness over this failure by turning his full attention to an important event that was being secretly planned in Berlin. The usual plotters intended to assassinate the Führer during the summer, probably in July. Roger Masson was now completely reassured. The Nazis could no longer get their hands on the least known but greatest and most effective secret agent of World War II. At the same time, he was placed in an embarrassing predicament. In fact, at the end of May and the beginning of June 1944, the Swiss government was in a state of terror. German troops were massing in Alsace, accompanied by transport planes. It was said that about 20 divisions had been observed within an area of 125 miles around the Swiss frontier. Herr Jaeger, the Swiss minister in Hungary, reported a rumor that had been circulated in Budapest. Switzerland was about to be invaded, as Hungary had been 3 months before. On June 5th, an apprehensive General Guisan called a meeting of his high command working committee. Huber, Gonard, Brocker, and Masson. Masson wondered whether the whole thing might be an act of revenge engineered by Schellenberg, but kept his suspicions to himself. It was now estimated, unofficially, that the German divisions in the 125-mile area numbered 35. What was the significance of these groupings? Masson, supported by Gonard, was in favor of a full mobilization. Huber, however, did not think that that situation was comparable to that of May and June of 1940. The Wehrmacht was then intact and victorious, hardly the case in June 44. Colonel Barbe, who had followed Guisan wherever he went, made the following revealing remarks in his wartime diary. 5th of June, struck, during this meeting by the fidelity with which the chief, General Gazan, sticks to his idea of a general mobilization, struck too by what was not said. No one, not even Masson, explained why the Viking line, which until then had been so remarkably productive, could not be of any use in these circumstances, unquote. The reason, of course, was obvious. Brigadier Masson could hardly let the whole world know that to save Switzerland, he'd been forced to imprison the head of this unique intelligence network. The next day, June 6, 1944, all Switzerland's fears disappeared. The Allies had landed in Normandy at Bois-Mermet. The detainees spent their days quietly. They had all been brought to the same prison. Rösler, Schneider, Dubenbacher, Foote, Hamel, and Boley, and put in separate, comfortable cells. On September 8, 1944, when they were completely out of danger, they were released. On his return to Wesemelin, where he found that nothing, not even his transmitter, had been disturbed, Rudolf Rösler wasted no time in sending out a call to his 10 friends in the OKW in Berlin. He feared for their safety. While in prison, he had had all the newspapers at his disposal and had followed closely the details of the July attempt on Hitler's life and the savage reprisals taken against the Wehrmacht High Command. He was deeply apprehensive of what might have happened to the Werther and Olga in all the turmoil. He stayed all night at his set, listening. No answer came. Every day he repeated the attempt. Finally, on September 15th, he received a reply. They were happy to know that he was safe and free. They had come through the July tumult unscathed. 10 times they had slipped through the net of purges, free suspicions. Better still, when Heinz Guderian was appointed chief of staff of the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht the day after the assassination attempt, he had fired all his colleagues except one. Their friend G. Werther could therefore continue its work. The Nazi beast was mortally wounded, but it was not yet dead. From September 16 onward, Rudolf Rösler began visiting his Swiss colleagues in the Bureau, H.A., once again. Unfortunately, his extreme valuable dispatches remained unused in a safe, together with the copies of his reports that had bled Germany to death. To whom could they be given, and why? In any case, the fate of Nazism was sealed. Well, the fate of Germany was sealed. For Switzerland, the war was already over. It had ended on September 5, 1944, when General Jean de Latre de Tassagny, Moroccan troops marched along its frontiers on their way to Germany. See, Moroccan troops employed by the Allies, and also Germany used them too. So this myth of, we're all just going to be fighting for the white race, it's just the white race going to be fighting, is bullshit. All the sides used colored troops. On that date, the Confederation lifted its blackout regulations. It was already making preparations for its peace celebrations. And remember, too, there were quite a number of blacks living in Germany all through the war. Yes, and they weren't bothered at all. And also, evidently, according to my information, the main synagogue in Berlin had never been touched and was open all during the war. It's all smell. The whole thing smells. There's so many things that don't make sense. It's ridiculous. After a long stay in a Lausanne hotel, Alexander Foote decided to try and get in touch with his colleagues. With careful searching, he located Rachel Dubendorfer at the end of November, thanks to Pierre Nicole, the son of the Swiss communist leader. From her, Foote learned that Radau, who had remained in hiding in Bern, had left for Paris in order to renew contact with the Russians, who had already opened an embassy there. "What are you going to do?" she asked. "Go to join them. Then before you go, you must see Lucy. He will give you some documents for the Russians." A meeting, the first meeting between these two men, who had worked so closely together, was arranged for December 15th at the Bolognese restaurant in the Kasernstrasse in Zurich. Foote arrived first with Sissy. At exactly midday, he saw a smallish man winding his way among the tables toward them. An unobtrusive man in his 50s with an emaciated face and feverish eyes blinking behind spectacles. At first sight, Roessler appeared a colorless enough figure, but Foote was fascinated by the subtle impression of power he emanated. Roessler nibbled at his food without interest, but he talked a great deal. In a quick, nervous, rather jerky way, he spoke of the war and of Nazism, which he said must be entirely purged from Germany. He handed Foote a bulging briefcase. Sissy tells me you're leaving for Paris. I want you to do something for me. Here are the latest plans of the Wehrmacht. Give them to the Russians. Tell them to work out a system which will enable me to continue to send them all the intelligence I received from Germany. My network was not affected by the reprisals that followed July 20th. This Germany must be crushed once and for all. As they were leaving the restaurant, Roessler repeated his request for a means of corresponding with Moscow. Do you think it's still worth it? Foote asked. I don't see what you mean, Roessler answered. Well, Foote explained, as things are at the moment, the war can't go on much longer. I have a feeling that the center no longer needs us, because the Red Army no longer needs the center. Our work is finished, Lucy, and we've got to realize it. I'll take these documents to Paris, but I think I know what they'll say. They'll say that it's all over. A sudden transformation seemed to come over Rudolf Roessler. He seemed to have aged. Without a word of goodbye to either Sissy or Alexander Foote, Roessler turned on his heels and walked off, muttering incredulously to himself, "All over?" Very often the existence of peoples who are revealed to the public by some dramatic event seems to end with the event itself. Yet they go on living, though usually deeply affected, sometimes even traumatized, by the events they have experienced. It seemed only right, therefore, that this book should not end as abruptly as the activities of the Lucy Ring, so we pursued our investigations beyond the war's end, to discover what had become of the principal actors in this extraordinary drama. Some seemed to have vanished without a trace, returning to the shadow world from which they came. Others, like Rachel Dubendorfer and Paul Buschner, set off for the USSR in 1945. No sooner had they arrived than they were quietly removed to the work camp of Siberia, where they remained for 12 years. Geez, thanks, buddy. Thanks, Stalin. Until their release in 1956 under Khrushchev's liberalization measures. Stalin had determined to get rid of any witnesses that might tarnish his reputation as a strategist of genius by revealing to the Russians, for example, that German resistors had helped him to defeat Hitler. Rudolf Roessler did not leave Switzerland in 1945. He continued to work with his publishing house, the Vita Nova Verlag, in Lucerne, and to live in his modest home in Westmoreland. You know, the next question there is, once this guy is known and has been exposed, and there's supposed to be this super Nazi underground of these guys like the guy in the movies, why wasn't he wiped out? I mean, it doesn't take much to get one guy, you know. There was all these movies are based on mostly bullshit. And first they tell how powerful and how devious and how cunning the Nazis were, and then they run them totally into the ground before the movie's over. He still had his transmitter receiver, but it lay unused and useless because there was no longer anyone on the other end, neither the Russians nor the Werther nor Olga. As Foote had predicted, the Russians no longer needed him, even when after the war he went to their fine new embassy in Bern and offered his services. Roessler found it even more inconceivable that when the war was over, his friends in the former OKW would leave him without news, no messages, no letters, no visits, nothing but silence. It was inexplicable. Well, it's not inexplicable, because that's how the intelligence services operate. Most of the time, they throw their best people aside when they're done with them. They, That's what intelligence work does. They use people to get what they want, and then usually they're tossed aside or even killed to keep their mouth shut. In their desire to free their country from Nazism, his 10 companions had not realized that the death of the Third Reich would bring about the death of Germany altogether. They would never be able to return to the pre-1933 Germany which they loved. They must have realized this when they saw the Red Army in Berlin itself, and the division of their country into two blocks, seeing at last the full results of their actions. A resistance in continuous operation since 1939, they made the terrible decision not to meet again, to ignore each other's existence. If this had indeed been his friend's state of mind, it was certainly not Roessler's. He had no regrets. What he had done in full awareness of the outcome. He knew that if Nazism had triumphed, the world would have known considerably more than 36 million dead. Well, it was more like 55 million, not to mention the dark night into which it would have been plunged. Roessler also realized that the end of Hitler and the end of Germany did not mean that all the Nazis had been exterminated. Many who were lying low would emerge later. Some had escaped punishment, while others, like the mysterious Galen, had changed sides and were working for the Western Allies until they could show their true colors. No, Foote had been wrong when he said that it was all over. His 10 friends might retire into their ivory towers, but Roessler would not give up. Well, of course, you know the European Police Agency, I forget what they call them now, that was developed by the Germans, Nazis, National Socialists, and they went right on operating after the war. In the spring of 1947, an officer in civilian dress, Captain Wolf, of the Czech legation in Switzerland, called on Roessler at his office in Vita Nova Verlag and asked him to draw up analysis of the military and strategic situation in Europe. Roessler agreed, convinced that by doing so he would be continuing to work for peace. In 1939, it was his friend Xavier Schnieper who had initiated him to active espionage work when he had introduced him to Major Hausemann of the Bureau of HA. Roessler now called on Schnieper's services, an increasingly left-wing Schnieper. In 1945, he had become chief librarian of the Canton of Lucerne. He then worked for the Caritas organization as literary director, which involved frequent visits to Prague. Schnieper joined the Swiss Socialist Party and became a journalist on the Volkskrant, which sent him to Bonn as a regular correspondent. In fact, it was there that Schnieper became Roessler's agent. He also met Czech Captain Wolf. When this officer returned home in 1951, Roessler and Schnieper corresponded with two other Czechs, known only by their nicknames, Conrad I and Conrad II. In January 1953, Roessler went to West Germany, to Dusseldorf, to write a 13-page report on military power in Europe. This report was intended for Czechoslovakia. First, however, it had to be sent to Zurich, to an agent whose sole function was to receive the mail and dispatch it to its real addressees. The report did not contain any major secrets. It had been based on the official publications circulating in NATO circles. However, Roessler thought fit to conceal it in a pot of honey for mailing. An anonymous person who had occupied a high post in West Germany and who had been following Roessler's activities for some time alerted the Swiss police. The parcel was intercepted. On March 1953, Otto Muhrer, a police officer of Lucerne, arrested Rudolf Roessler and Xavier Schnieper. They were given 242 days of preventative detention before being brought to trial on Monday, November 2, 1953. This was the time it had taken for the Swiss police to gather the case, or to make up their own case, as some people suggested. The trial lasted for 3 days. The federal judge, Corradi, presided over the penal tribunal of Lucerne, assisted by judges Pometta, Rice, Albrecht, and Schwartz. The prosecution was led by the assistant public prosecutor, Heine. Roessler was defended by Scour of Bern and Schnieper by Eckert of Basel. Roessler and Schnieper were charged with spying on the West German Federal Republic for Czechoslovakia, of sending 160 reports to Prague in exchange for 33,000 Swiss francs. The defense proved that these reports were based on publications that could be bought by anyone in any bookshop. Yet Roessler was condemned to 1 year's imprisonment and Schnieper to 9 months. You see how everybody knifes each other in the back? Yeah, it's not just the right-wing, so phony conservative racial leaders and even followers that do this. Everybody does it. Roessler realized that the Confederation had changed. This was no longer the Switzerland it had been accommodating towards his activities, that from 1939 had accepted the secrets of the OKW and Berlin, that had allowed the transmission of so much intelligence to the Soviet Union, and which in 1945 had presented him with an expression of gratitude for his conduct during the war. Disillusioned, indifferent, and exhausted, Rudolf Roessler died in October 1958. Few people attended his funeral at the Kriens. His colleagues and Xavier Schnieper, none of his wartime comrades, were there. He went, as spies always do, even the greatest of them, discreetly. A small marble plaque bears the simple statement, Rudolf Roessler, 1897 to 1958. Xavier Schnieper still lives in Lucerne, where he worked as a journalist and writer. He often meets Roessler's former partners, who still run the Vita Nova Verlag, but he rarely sees Major Hans Hausemann, now a photographer in Zurich, the former head of the Bureau, H.A., to whom he introduced the German émigré in 1939. Although Hausemann was reluctant to receive us and to answer questions regarding Roessler or the Lucy Ring, in the course of the television broadcast in Zurich on May 17, 1966, he confirmed that his office, the Bureau of H.A., had financed Roessler throughout the conflict, knowing perfectly well he was working for the Russians. In 1945, as the Third Reich was drawing to its agonized end, Walter Schellenberg arrived at the Swiss frontier with a party of Scandinavian internees whom he had freed from concentration camps on the occasion with the agreement of Heinrich Himmler. Schellenberg knew that one never arrives empty-handed when one wants something. What he wanted was asylum. Count Bernadotte agreed to let him stay temporarily in Stockholm. Bernadotte also helped him get to Britain. On June 16, 1945, a transport plane took him secretly to London. In exchange, Schellenberg had promised to reveal everything he knew concerning matters that interested the British government. Such a proposition coming from the head of the SD, who must have sensational information on the events that had taken place in the world since 1933 and on the men who had directed them, was too valuable to spurn. For 3 years, Schellenberg revealed enough to satisfy the curiosity of the British agents. The result was an impressive harvest of intelligence, though of course the experts of the intelligence service had to evaluate it with exemplary care, for Schellenberg often lied or twisted the facts to his own advantage. But the truth that emerged more than justified the time and energy spent in obtaining it. On January 4, 1946, Schellenberg gave evidence against the Nazi leaders at Nuremberg. No one surprised when he returned to London, flanked by two nurses. Schellenberg was a sick man. Stones were forming in his bladder. Back in London, he was given treatment. When it fully recovered, the interrogation continued. In 1948, squeezed dry of intelligence by the British, he was called up before the International Court that was still in session in Nuremberg. Schellenberg appeared before the judges toward the end of spring of 1949. The British and Americans agreed to an acquittal, but the Soviet delegate protested strongly. Naturally, the Russians found it incredible that the Western Allies should want to acquit the former head of the SD. As a result, Schellenberg was given 4 years. In 1952, 3 years after his condemnation, the British had him released on health grounds. He knew where to go. He got in touch with his old enemy, Roger Masson, moved somewhat by Schellenberg's obvious physical and mental deterioration, Masson did what he could secretly for the Swiss not take kindly to such help. He entrusted Schellenberg to one of his friends, a surgeon called Lang, who hid him near the Romont, halfway between Lucerne and Freiburg. After a few months' respite, the federal authorities learned of his presence and ordered his immediate expulsion. It was little more than an invalid that left the shores of Lake Como, where he was supported by... It's interesting. Let's see. One of my in-laws, retired upper echelon U.S. Air Force officer, retired at Lake Como there in Italy. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. I think I met him one time at a family get-together. I'm trying to remember what... let's see. He was the brother of my wife's mother. Yeah. So anyhow, just a little side issue there. We never talked about anything but just how's the weather. In case people are thinking he gave me a bunch of secrets. He was pretty high up, though, I know that. He began writing his memoirs, but they were finished by a German journalist. Great was the relief among a number of people when they finally appeared to see that Schellenberg had in fact revealed very little. He died in the autumn of 1954. One of the most intimate witnesses to this extraordinary affair, Alexander Foote, also wrote a book, a small, deliberately incomplete work on the advice, no doubt, of the British Counterintelligence Service, for Foote had left the Communist Party and lived respectively in Britain until his death in 1958. In December 1944, after his first and only meeting with Rudolf Rösler, Lucy, in the Bolognese in Zurich, Foote went to Paris with the documents given him by Lucy. This mass of intelligence provided an entry to the Soviet embassy, where at first he was thought to be an agent provocateur. The expert who examined the papers immediately got in touch with the center, which said that Foote was to go to Moscow. He was to travel with Alexander Radow, who had been in Paris for some weeks. Radow and Foote celebrated their reunion with caviar and vodka. Under the effects of the alcohol, Radow lost some of his caution. He admitted he was frightened, first because he had abandoned his post at a dangerous moment, and second because he had never been able to distinguish between the money he had resent from the running of his network and his own salary. He knew he had embezzled something like $50,000. What could he do? He went into hiding. He would be condemned just as surely as if he had admitted to working for the Nazis. If the MGB really wanted to rid itself of an agent, they would find him. On January 6, 1945, at 9 a.m., the first Soviet plane to leave Paris since 1939 took off from Le Bourget. On board was a cargo of Russian officers and two civilians, Foote and Radow. The pilot was to make a vast detour. There was no point in exposing oneself to the possible danger of flying over Germany. The war was not quite over yet. They would reach Moscow via Egypt and Turkey and break the journey for 48 hours in Cairo. When the DC-3 took off again at dawn on January 9th, one of the civilian passengers was no longer there. Radow had disappeared into the Egyptian night. On January 11th, Foote was in Moscow. He was warmly welcomed and even given a charming female interpreter who took care of him until he was called before a commission that examined his conduct during the war. He had no difficulty in proving that he had been unable to escape arrest in November 43, which he deprived the Red Army of Lucy's valuable information. He was questioned lengthily about Lucy and about the functioning of the network. Then, freed from any trace of suspicion, he was sent to the famous spy school at Sagdalia, after which no doubt he was ready once more to serve. Foote proved a brilliant pupil and was even given the rank of major in the Red Army, which brought with it a more than adequate salary. In the course of the summer of 45, he learned by chance at Szczekłowo that Radow had finally been extradited from Cairo, where he was discovered by agents of the MGB, judged at once and executed. Whoa! the news of the treatment meted out to former head of his network, proof enough that one could never trifle with the center, did nothing to deepen Foote's conviction that the communism was still the best possible social system at man's disposal. Gradually, as his experience as a secret agent grew, he began to lose his illusions. At the beginning of March 47, Foote's masters considered that he was ready to confront the capitalist world once more, and he was flown to East Berlin. Foote decided he would get out at the first good opportunity. He had a new identity, that of Albert Mueller, a German. At the end of July, he was to be posted into Mexico, where he was to work with the resident director of a network spying on the United States. The time had come, he thought, to change sides. On August 2, 1947, he escaped and presented himself to the authorities of the British sector of Berlin. For the next 11 years, Alexander Foote worked for the British government, but he might never have gone back to Britain had he known that Alexander Ratto was not dead and that he had been told so only as a warning. Ratto is now professor of geography at the University of Budapest, old but still useful, despite 12 years spent like Rachel Dubendorfer in a Siberian work camp. And what of the other characters in this drama? Many of them are dead, like General Kazan, who was accompanied to the Pully Cemetery in Lausanne in April 12, 1960, by more than 200,000 Swiss soldiers who came down spontaneously from their mountains to pay their last respects to the man who had realized that total neutrality would not have saved the Confederation between 39 and 45. And who had preferred an active neutrality. But one of the most tormented actors in this tragedy, along with Rudolf Roessler, was Walter Schellenberg. And Walter Schellenberg was Roger Masson. Long ago, France could have given him the Legion of Honor, Britain its Distinguished Service Order, America its Distinguished Service Cross, and the Soviet Union its Red Star. Like Kazan, he was to serve the Allies' cause. In the interests of Switzerland, one might even be permitted to wonder why post-war Switzerland, which condemned Rudolf Roessler to prison, did not also deal with its former Secret Service chief, as Walter Schellenberg had foreseen when he planned his scheme to force Masson to visit him in September 42. It was Masson who had to take the blame when, after the war, the facts were exposed. It had happened in a particularly cruel way. On September 28, 45, the Swiss press announced that on the 21st of the month, Roger Masson had disclosed in an interview with the Chicago Daily News that during the war he had met Walter Schellenberg, head of the SD, on several occasions, the first in Germany, then subsequently in Switzerland. Two federal deputies, Herr Dietschy, a radical from Basel, and Herr Bringhoff, a socialist from Schaffhaus, immediately attacked Masson. They expressed astonishment that such context had been taken place, inferred that the head of the Swiss Secret Service had been duped by Schellenberg, and declared that, in any case, Masson had considerably exceeded the brief that he had been entrusted to him. They demanded that an inquiry into the whole affair be opened at once. To suppose from what is known of the facts that Masson was the victim of Schellenberg's strongest personality is to judge too hastily the very delicate situation in which he found himself. It is also too ignorant the advantages for the Confederation of maintaining a contact with the Nazis. Although in June 43 the federal consul had to threaten Masson with severe sanctions to prevent him from going to Berlin to meet Schellenberg, and although in October 43 Masson received the Germans once again for a long weekend at Wolfsburg, and despite the fact that over numerous protests and expulsion order drawn up by the federal consul, Masson continued to receive Schellenberg's adjutant Egan on Swiss territory right up until 1945. Only on one other occasion, after Masson had refused him the identities of the members of the Lucy Ring, did Schellenberg, who on countless occasions had granted Switzerland's request, himself asked Masson for something. And on that occasion, April 11, 1944, Masson showed how cool, even severe, he could be towards the SS general. 2 days before a German fighter plane landed at the Swiss military airfield in Dubendorf near Zurich, the plane was intact. The pilot told the head of the Swiss base that he had landed his there intentionally and he had had enough of the war. His was no ordinary fighter plane, but a Messerschmitt 110 specifically equipped for night fighting, a prototype that was still secret. Apart from the traditional equipment, it was armed with two vertical firing 30mm guns, a formidable machine. On hearing of this catastrophe, Göring flew into a furious rage. He sent for Schellenberg and ordered him to dispatch the head of his commandos of Section 6F, the famous Otto Skorzeny, to Switzerland at once. With 30 men, Skorzeny was to go to Dubendorf and blow up the plane before the Allies discovered it. This would be easy enough since 10,000 people a day were flocking to admire from the edge of the airfield all the American and British bombers which had been forced by anti-aircraft fire to make forced landings on Swiss territory. Schellenberg got in touch not with Skorzeny but with Masson. He knew that an intervention by the excitable Skorzeny at Dubendorf would constitute a veritable cause belli. He simply got Masson to have the Messerschmitt 110 destroyed in the presence of the German military attaché in Bern in exchange for her cooperation. Switzerland was the last allowed to acquire 12 Messerschmitts 10GS, which she had coveted for some years. 12 Messerschmitts 10GS in April 44 when the Luftwaffe was being bled on all fronts. 2 months before the Normandy landing, during which only two German fighters took the air, was a high price to pay for two 30mm guns, even if they could fire vertically. Nevertheless, Dietschy and Springhoff had their way. Judge Couchpin opened a government inquiry on October 23, 45. On January 28, 46, he published his conclusions. Masson was entirely exonerated of any suspicion. Entirely? Such attacks always leave their scars. Even today, there are pro-Masson and anti-Masson parties in Switzerland. The same people as those in 45 who believed it, Judge Couchpin, and those who did not. Roger Masson has never really recovered from the accusations made against him because he has never been able to tell the truth. He has never been able to defend himself in broad daylight because of the oath of secrecy that prevents him from revealing the slightest details about his still recent, still controversial period. His military career was cut short that September 28, 45. From that, too, he has never recovered. We met him several times at the Hotel de Lausanne in the center of that city. Masson feels at home there. When he was head of the Swiss Secret Service, he often used his large, discreet hotel for appointments. With its numerous exits and its proximity to the station, it was particularly suitable for meetings that should go unnoticed. Today, 20 years later, it was there that he arranged to meet us. He received us cordially and talked freely of his meetings with Schellenberg. But when one day we asked him certain embarrassing questions concerning Rudolf Roessler, Brigadier Masson rose to his feet, looked straight at us, and without a word walked away. We did not see him again. The day before he had said to us, quote, "A few days ago it was my 70th birthday. I spent it quietly at home on Mount Pirlin, the hill overlooking Vevey. To my great surprise, the postman arrived that morning with hundreds of letters. Hundreds of men had remembered, former colleagues of mine. It was my best birthday in 20 years, unquote. As for Switzerland itself, the country that formed the background to this extraordinary chapter in history, was it too marked by events? The Swiss do not like it to be said, but the Confederation did not suffer from the war. Switzerland was bombed on a few occasions accidentally. Berglin in October 41, Basel and Zurich in December of the same year. These were mistakes made by the RAF. There were a small number of victims. In autumn 44, the American Air Force also accidentally bombed the railway station at Delamont. The Solothurn Motiers train and the Basel Zurich Express near Pratlin, Mogens, was bombed. On February 22, 45, 11 raids on Stein am Rhein and Ruf killed 18 Swiss and wounded 50. On March 4, it was Zurich's turn. These were all the result of aerial attacks and objectives situated near the frontier. Their calculations were a few miles off. Contrary to what has often been claimed, Switzerland was never seriously short of food. Far from it. The most it ever suffered was a temporary rationing of various foodstuffs. During the war, Switzerland performed a number of services that supported its popular image. Parcels sent from the Confederation did much to alleviate the distress of prisoners of war. Between November 40 and December 42, Switzerland gave a three-month holiday to 21,365 children from France, Belgium, and Yugoslavia. But one cannot forget that the same Switzerland turned away thousands of Jew children who ended their lives in gas chambers. We took in hundreds of thousands of them, it was often said. It should be explained that out of the 100,000 refugees accepted by the Confederation between 33 and 45, there were exactly 21,944 Jews. To conclude this painful chapter in Switzerland's history, we feel we cannot do better than borrow the words of the Dutch government. In 1952, in a report on the attitude of Switzerland towards the Netherlands, it wrote, quote, "We should both thank Switzerland for refraining from doing so. It should not have been forgotten either that Switzerland gave invaluable help to the enemies of Germany and was the sole Switzerland that an indispensable one to defeat Hitler." If it is true that the Secret Services contributed more to victory than on the battlefield than do the generals, then without a doubt Switzerland had a rightful share in the victory of 45. Without Switzerland and the hospitality her government gave to Rudolf Rosler's anti-Nazi resistance network, the war might well have ended differently. This affair was undoubtedly also responsible for the final collapse of the myth of Swiss neutrality. In its place, a new image of the Confederation had emerged, that of a country sharing, like every other country, in the glory and the horror of the world's great upheavals. Contrary to what has often been said, history has not deserted Switzerland. And that's the end of the reading of The Man Called Lucy. You may want to still get a book. They're still available by the big book outfits. That's the kind of stuff you need to cherry pick out and read, because there's so much more to it than the popular press puts out. And it's so sad that millions of young Germans and white Russians died when it was all going down the tube. I mean, Russia allegedly won in one way, but at what cost? 27 million people of their population. Can you imagine that, if 27 million white Americans were wiped out? And on all those crazy misthought out battle plans of Hitler and all that, it's almost would have been better for Rosler's material to have been given to those allies, in Western Europe, Belgium, Holland, all those, and they would have accepted it and acted upon it. They could have slowed down the German forces, and Hitler might have thought again twice about invading Russia. And if the Soviet Union or Russia would have accepted his intelligence information right as Operation Barbarossa took off, the Russians, even though, you know, lost some big battles there, but mainly because they didn't accept Rosler's information. And so the German forces probably never could have got even near Leningrad. And then, of course, the stupidity of Hitler by wasting 1 million men on Leningrad. I mean, It is so insane that you don't even want to think about it. I mean, you think about it, and it drives you crazy. It drives me crazy thinking about all the good white men on all sides that died for nothing. That's why we have to fight for race, not politics, not Republican, not Democrat, not liberal, not conservative, not for all the other bullshit, churches and all that kind of stuff. You fight for one thing, your race. And you do try to do your best not to wipe out white people of other countries. Well, gee, I've run through another show here. Well, that took longer than I thought. That's it for today, and I'll be back with you tomorrow on Thursday. I'm not sure what's going to happen. I got to go into the doctor tomorrow and get a little surgical thing done, and then I'll be home. And if I don't have a new show, we'll run an older show. So, but don't worry, we're still going to be here. 14-5.
Famous day in history, the men of the 7th Cavalry went riding on. And from the rear a voice was heard, a brave young man with a trembling word went loud and clear.
What am I doing here? Please, Mr. Custer, I don't want to go. Hey, Mr. Custer, please don't make me go. I had a dream last night about to come in and fight. Somebody yelled attack. Below I stood with the arrow in my back. Please, Mr. Custer, I don't want to go. Bushes out there. They're moving. There's the engine behind every one. Hey, Mr. Custer, you mind if I'll be excused the rest of the afternoon?
Hey, Charlie, duck your head.
Oh, you led a bit late on that one, Charlie. I bet that smarts.
They were sure of victory, the men of the 7th Cavalry, as they rode on. Again from the rear a voice was heard, that same great voice with a trembling word went loud and clear.
What am I doing here?
Please, Mr. Custer, I don't want to go. Listen, Mr. Custer, please don't make me go. I don't want to go.
No.
I wonder what the engine word for friend is. Let's see, friend. Kimasabi, that's it.
Kimasabi. Hey out there, Kimasabi.
Well, that isn't it. Look at him out there. Running around like a bunch of wild engines. Oh, I see no time for joking.